Chapter 5, Widening Circles. The YMBA had been established in May as the Young Men's Buddhist Association Kalimpong, and its objects were to unite the young men in Kalimpong and to propagate the teachings of Buddhism by means of social, educational and religious activities. Towards the end of the year, the name of the organisation was changed to the Young Men's Buddhist Association in brackets India, while its two objects were combined and enlarged into the single object of disseminating the teaching of the Buddha among the young men of India by means of social, cultural and religious activities. The head office of the association remained in Kalimpong. These changes reflected our recognition of the fact that although the work of the YMBA was confined to Kalimpong, it was in principle capable of a much wider extension. Indeed, they reflected our recognition of the fact that the process of extension had already begun. A few months earlier, Kashyapji had paid a brief visit to the city of Ajmer in Rajputana, on the other side of India. In consequence of this visit, members of the Kolya Rajput community, who claimed to be the modern descendants of the Kolya clan, to which belonged Maya Devi, the mother of the future Buddha, had formed a YMBA of their own. And in October or November, this organisation affiliated itself to us as our first branch. The moving spirit behind the affiliation was Ram Singh Chawawa, a pushing young man who later studied Buddhism for a few months in Burma and changed his name to Rahula Suman Chawawa. As secretary of the Ajmer branch, he tried to start activities there on the model we had already established and brought the work of the YMBA to the attention of a growing number of people in northwest India. Both inside and outside Kalimpong, we were getting better known. In Kalimpong itself, we were becoming better known, partly on account of the lectures I was giving under the auspices of the Institute of Culture. The Institute was the darling brainchild of a middle-aged Bengali named Mr. Indra, who, with his stick, Bengali shawl and almost obsequious politeness, was a well-known figure in Kalimpong. Meetings were held once a month in a small hotel, or rather boarding house, of which Mr. Indra was the proprietor. Before long, I was a favourite speaker. My first lecture, the first of many, was given towards the end of September and was on the subject of the way to Nirvana. Quote, stressing that religion was not the negation but the fulfillment of life, the speaker said that the way to Nirvana, the middle way or noble eightfold path taught by the Buddha, was the path of the higher evolution which led men from humanity to superhumanity, to Buddhahood, just as the path of the lower evolution led him from animality to humanity. Religion was therefore a perfectly natural thing, the finest flowering of life. It consisted in complete unfoldment of the latent spiritual faculties of man. It was a matter of being and becoming, not of mere blind faith or unintelligent acceptance. Moreover, it was a process in which every individual human being participated. For every single action, whether of thought, word or deed, was fraught with spiritual significance and carried the doer either upwards towards Nirvana or downwards away from it. End of quote. So far as I know, this was the first time I had spoken of Buddhism as the path of the higher evolution, and the first time I had distinguished this from the path of the lower evolution. From what obscure corner of my reading I produced these terms, or indeed whether I coined them, or thought I coined them, myself for the occasion, I no longer recollect. In any case, it was not until a quarter of a century later that I took them up again and attempted to give a more detailed and systematic interpretation of Buddhism along evolutionary lines. Meanwhile, I almost always wrote and spoke of it in purely traditional terms. The reason why, in my first lecture at the Institute of Culture, I departed from my usual practice was that its membership consisted, for the most part, of westernized and secularized Bengali Hindus, who might perhaps conceivably find Buddhism more intelligent and more acceptable if it was presented to them in terms of modern thought. This is not to say that such an approach was not liable to misunderstanding. Among the 30 or more people who attended the lecture were two newly arrived Seventh-day Adventist missionaries, one American and one Dutch. As I left, I heard one of them say to the other, with a dismissive nod of the head, "It's a form of naturalism." Perhaps he had taken too literally what I had said about religion being a perfectly natural thing. By this I did not mean to reduce it from a spiritual to a mundane activity, or to deny the existence of the transcendental element in religion, religion itself being indeed nothing but the science and the art of the transcendental, but only to draw attention to man's inherent affinity with that element, which was in truth not something imposed upon him from without, as in Christian supernaturalism, but something rather developed from within. One of the first signs that we were becoming better known outside Kalimpong was the appearance on the veranda of the Dharmodia Vihara one day towards the end of the rainy season of two tired and footsore young aspirants to enlightenment and monastic ordination. They had come to us from Sarnath. Indeed, they had been sent to us from Sarnath. Whether the Mahabodhi Society monks there really believed we were in a position to provide them with the facilities they required, or whether they had merely found it a convenient way of getting rid of them, I do not know. The fact was that the monks had assured the two young aspirants that Kalimpong was the best possible place for them, the YMBA the best possible organisation, and Sangharakshita the best possible guide, philosopher and friend. To Kalimpong, therefore, had they come. They were an oddly assorted pair. By coincidence, they had arrived at Sarnath at the same time and for the same purpose, and finding themselves treated with equal indifference by the resident monks, spent most of their time together and became good friends. Their names were Wee and Saraswati. Wee was a smiling but taciturn straight Chinese of about 20, with the usual plump face and gold-filled teeth. Saraswati, a slender, worried-looking North Indian Brahmin of about 17. The former wore a crumpled Western suit, the latter the more traditional white dhoti and shirt. As they stood forlornly there on the veranda, dripping with rain, I remembered my own difficulties and disappointments in connection with ordination and decided to take them in. During the time that they were at the Vihara, they gave me no cause to regret this decision. They joined me in my morning puja and meditation, studied the Dharma together, and helped Joe with the cooking and shopping, sat in on the evening tutorial classes, and made friends among the students. In short, they were model disciples. Unfortunately, they had been at the Vihara only 3 weeks when the world they thought they had left behind forever caught up with them. At least, it caught up with Saraswati. Late one afternoon, there appeared on the veranda an elderly Indian Brahmin wearing a white dhoti and shirt and carrying a black umbrella. It was Saraswati's father. As soon as Saraswati saw him, the colour left his face. He fell at the old man's feet with a cry. The old man bent down to embrace him, and both of them burst into tears. The upshot of this affecting scene was that, after a brief argument, Saraswati reluctantly agreed to accompany his father home and go back to college. They left the next morning. Deprived of the company of his friend, Wee became sad and restless, and on my advice, eventually returned to Malaya and entered a Chinese monastery in order to undergo the traditional training. We and Saraswati were not the only persons I had to take in during that rainy season. There was at least one more. He came not from Sarnath, but from Rajgir, and had been sent not by the Mahabodhi Society monks, but by my own teacher, Jagdish Kashyap. Far from being an aspirant to enlightenment and ordination, the newcomer already wore the yellow robes of the Shramanera, or novice monk, having been ordained by Kashyapji himself at Rajgir a few months earlier. Kamalashila, as my teacher had named him, was a very thin, very dark, very talkative Bihari of about my own age. Why Kashyapji had named him Kamalashila was not immediately apparent to me. The original Kamalashila had been a celebrated Buddhist philosopher of the Sautrantika Vijnanavada school, the author of a commentary on the encyclopedic Tattva Sangraha of his master Shantarakshita, and one of the brightest ornaments of the ancient Buddhist monastic university of Nanda. The latter-day Kamalashila had no interest in Buddhist philosophy whatever. Indeed, he seemed to have no interest in Buddhism. His real interest was in nature cure, and it was he who had set up the nature cure clinic at the Japanese Buddhist temple about which Kashyapji had told me on his last visit. Reading between the lines of a letter of introduction with which Kashyapji had provided him, and listening to his own rather negative account of how the clinic was being run, I could not help thinking that there had been a disagreement between him and his teacher, and it was on account of this disagreement that he had left Rajgir. Be that as it may, before long there was certainly a disagreement between him and me, and it was certainly on account of this disagreement that he left Kalimpong. The disagreement was over Buddhism itself. Kamalashila declared that such things as puja and meditation and the study of Buddhist texts were a waste of time. What was really needed was social work. Buddhist monks ought to be social workers. Whether he went so far as to say that social workers were the true Buddhist monks, I cannot be sure. But he certainly said enough to leave me wondering why Kashyapji had ordained him, especially as he had never ordained anybody before and might have been expected to exercise extreme caution in the selection of the first of his own Shramanera disciples. In any case, Kamalashila had only the haziest of ideas about what constituted social work. So far as I could make out, it meant little more than going from place to place, exhorting everybody to work hard for the good of the nation. Although he was less well-educated, there was more than a touch of Anthony Elenjimitan about Kamalashila. Despite our disagreement over Buddhism, which made it difficult for him to stay long at the Vihara, the talkative Bihari Shramanera and I parted quite amicably, and he left Kalimpong for Assam with a large bundle of stepping stones to distribute. As it happened, this was the best thing he could have done. The Barua, Thai and Tamang Buddhists of Assam, who had very little contact with the rest of the Buddhist world, were glad to see him on account of his robe, on account of the news he brought of Buddhist activities in Kalimpong, and on account of the copies of stepping stones he distributed so lavishly among them. As for Kamalashila himself, with his restless spirit, he was glad to be constantly on the move, glad to be continually meeting new people, glad to be doing something useful. In the course of a couple of months, he covered practically the entire state, penetrating into remote Buddhist villages, spreading news of the YMBA, and enrolling subscribers to Stepping Stones. In this way, we became well known to the Buddhists of Assam. On his way back to Rajgir, Kamalashila spent a few days with us in Kalimpong. For the next 2 years, this was to be his regular program. After spending a few months at the Japanese Buddhist temple with Kashyapji and Nature Cure, he would come up to Kalimpong, collect a bundle of stepping stones, and be off with them to Assam, visiting us on the way back to report on the success of his mission. Thanks to his efforts, by the time I visited Assam myself a few years later, the ground was well prepared. Though Kamalashila was our only colporteur, and though his travels, extensive though they may have been, were confined to a single state of the Indian Union, it was in fact mainly through stepping stones that the YMBA was becoming better known outside Kalimpong. The flashes sent out by the second beautiful iridescent ball we had invited to descend were indeed more brilliant than those sent out by the first, and were indeed being seen even further afield. The second ball was, in fact, now illuminating the first. At the same time, the second ball itself, as refracted through the medium of stepping stones, was shifting its colours slightly, incorporating here a brighter hue, there a more delicate tint, so as to create a richer and more harmonious effect. In the course of the first 6 months of its existence, our monthly journal of Himalayan religion, culture and education had attracted not only more and more readers and subscribers, but also a number of gifted new contributors, each of whom was helping to make it a more adequate embodiment of the idea with which it had been started. The first of our new contributors was Dr. R. Nebesky de Wachowitz, a young Austrian anthropologist who had arrived in Kalimpong with Dr. Rock and who was staying with him at the Himalayan Hotel and functioning in a secretarial capacity. He was gathering material for a book on the oracles and demons of Tibet, as he called them, and in order to do original research on the subject, was studying Tibetan, both classical and colloquial. For one reason or another, the life he led with Dr. Rock was not an easy one, and he sometimes relieved his feelings towards that peppery old gentleman by telling stories about him that were not always to the latter's credit. One of his favourite stories was of how Dr. Rock had, in the interests of anthropology, once spent several months as the third wife of a Lolo chief. Among our other new contributors were Lama Anagarika Govinda and Alfred Sorensen, alias Sri Shunyata, as he also called himself. Lama Govinda had hailed the appearance of stepping stones with great enthusiasm, sending me letters of advice and encouragement after every issue, and promising support and cooperation. The cooperation was not long in coming, taking first the form of a parable entitled Look Deeper, in which a terror of Nalanda is taught by Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, to see a village girl not as a bag of bones, but as a living and suffering fellow creature, and afterwards that of a whole series of brilliant and inspiring articles. The first of these articles, which appeared in the November issue, was entitled The Universal Perspective of the Bodhisattva Ideal. In it, Lama Govinda struck a characteristic note, declaring, quote, "The surest way to get rid of the ego is to see ourselves in the proper perspective to the rest of the world, that is, in the universal perspective, which has been opened by the teachings of the enlightened ones, illustrated by their lives, and emphasized by the teachers of the great vehicle. As long as we see life only through the pinpoint of our ordinary human consciousness, it seems to make no sense, while if we could see the whole picture of the universe as mirrored in the mind of an enlightened one, we would discover its meaning." End of quote. Alfred Sorensen, alias Sri Shunyata, or Mr. Emptiness, was a Dane who had become a Indian sadhu, or holy man. Prince Peter had written an article about him for the October issue of Stepping Stones, and it was through this article that he had come to know of our existence. Thereafter, he was a regular correspondent, sending me long, rhapsodizing letters about the Himalayas and the spiritual life. Sometimes the letters were accompanied by richly poetic articles and stories. Sometimes the letters themselves turned into articles. In either case, what he had written needed a good deal of rather drastic editing, not to say pruning, before it was fit for publication. My own contribution to Stepping Stones consisted mainly, and most importantly, of the editorials that appeared at the front of the issues. In these editorials, I continued to strike the same unambiguously spiritual note that I had struck in the first issue. Not unnaturally, my choice of topic was generally determined by my own current preoccupations, both as an individual Buddhist and as a member of the Buddhist spiritual community. Having spoken in the first issue of The Way, I went on to speak in subsequent issues of unity and of the voice within, besides asserting that everything that lives is holy, and dealing with the problem of desire, and describing the awakening of the heart. In connection with each of these topics, I tried to give direct expression to my deepest experiences and most dearly held beliefs. I tried to communicate, in fact, my vision of Buddhism, sometimes in contradistinction to the various erroneous views about it current in various quarters. The editorial entitled Unity was a plea for selflessness and mutual interpenetration among the followers of the Buddha. The editorial entitled The Voice Within was an indictment of the intolerable weight of the external, whether secular or religious. The editorial Everything That Lives Is Holy was a reminder that the presence or absence of ego consciousness was the true criterion of the spiritual value of an action, and so on. With so much of my time being taken up by the YMBA and Stepping Stones, I was unable to do much in the way of literary work, and for months together the editorials were my sole literary productions. That is to say, they were my sole literary productions in prose. Inspired as I was by the sights and sounds of Kalimpong, the writing of poems went on without interruption. Haiku and other verse forms continued to mirror external images and internal moods. Besides writing the poems, I was also getting some of them published. If the YMBA was becoming better known outside Kalimpong mainly through Stepping Stones, I myself was becoming better known outside Kalimpong, better known outside the small world of Indian Buddhist revival, mainly through my poems. For the past several years, I had contributed both poems and articles to journals like the Mahabodhi in Calcutta and the Vedanta Kasari, Madras. But as the house journals of particular religious movements, these publications had a limited appeal, and therefore only a small circulation. In the same month that Stepping Stones came into existence, my poems started appearing in the Illustrated Weekly of India. This was the leading magazine of its kind in the whole country. Published from Bombay under the editorship of C.R. Mandy, an English litterateur, it circulated widely among the English-educated middle class, being read literally from the Himalayas to Cape Comorin. Copies were even available in Kalimpong. The first of my poems to appear in the Illustrated was Village India, which I had written in Bihar a few weeks before coming to Kalimpong. The second was The Bodhisattva, written in Kalimpong itself, and reflecting the deep influence that was being exerted upon me by the Bodhisattva ideal, especially as depicted in Shantideva's Shiksha Samuchaya. For many years, this was one of my most popular poems, being reprinted in Buddhist magazines all over the world. In it, the Bodhisattva, speaking in his own person, gives expression to his determination not to enter into the bliss of nirvana until all beings, down to a blade of grass, have entered into it first. He is willing to postpone his own nirvana and even to endure endless torments so long as even one living being remains undelivered from suffering. Was it a coincidence that I wrote this poem only a few weeks after establishing personal contact through correspondence with one who was widely hailed as a bodhisattva after his death and who did, in effect, deliver millions of people from suffering? The name of Dr. B.R. Ambedkar, the great scheduled caste leader of Western India, had been familiar to me since the previous year when I had first heard of it in connection with the controversies over the proposed Hindu code bill, which he, as law minister, was drafting for presentation to the Indian Parliament. More recently, I had read the characteristically pungent article on the Buddha and the future of his religion that he had contributed to the Vaishakha number of the Mahabodhi. In fact, towards the end of June, I had written to him expressing my appreciation of this article and telling him about the formation of the YMBA, and about 10 days later had received an encouraging reply. This exchange of ours was to have momentous consequences. Through Village India and the Bodhisattva and the rest of the poems that appeared in the Illustrated Weekly over the years, I became known to tens of thousands of cultivated middle-class people who appreciated English poetry of the more traditional type. As a result of my contact with Dr. Ambedkar, I became known, towards the end of the decade, to hundreds of thousands of despised and rejected ex-untouchable people who, inspired by the example of their great leader, had burst asunder the age-old shackles of orthodox Hinduism and gone for refuge to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. In the concluding paragraph of his letter, Ambedkar wrote, "Great responsibility lies on the shoulders of the bhikkhus if this attempt at the revival of Buddhism is to be a success. They must be more active than they have been. They must come out of their shell and be in the front rank of the fighting forces. I'm glad you have started the YMBA in Kalimpong. You should be even more active than that." 3 months later, I took Ambedkar's words quite literally. If Kalimpong was my shell, I came out of it. At the beginning of October, the YMBA, having apparently been established on a sufficiently secure footing to be able to function without me for a few days, I paid a brief visit to Darjeeling for the purpose of establishing personal contacts with representatives of religious and humanitarian organisations. I did not go alone. With me went Sachin. A few weeks earlier, he had been elected Assistant Games Secretary, and this not only involved him more deeply in the work of the YMBA, but had also brought him into closer personal contact with me. When I decided to go to Darjeeling, he therefore decided to go too. He would give me what help he could in my mission, and also pay a surprise visit to his maternal grandmother and other relations. Darjeeling was 32 miles from Kalimpong by road, but only 15 miles away, so I was told, as the crow flies. It was scattered along a ridge at a height of 8,000 feet on the other side of the River Teesta. This meant that in order to get there from Kalimpong, one first plunged down 4,000 feet to the valley, or rather to the bottom of the crack between the two hillsides, crossed over Teesta Bridge, then shot up 8,000 feet through tropical jungle, tea gardens and tracts of pine forest to Goom, by a series of hairpin bends even longer and more acute than those by which one had come down from Kalimpong to Teesta Bridge, all in the space of 2 to 2.5 hours, depending on the precise degree of impatience and recklessness on the driver's part. This was altogether too much for my stomach, and between Goom and Darjeeling, I was violently sick. Hardly without exception, this was to be my experience on nearly all my subsequent visits to Darjeeling, at least until I discovered Carr's sickness tablets, and the fact may have accounted for the somewhat mixed feelings with which I came to regard the Queen of the Hill Stations. On the present occasion, having recovered from the effects of the journey and adjusted to the change of altitude, I started looking about me. Darjeeling was much bigger than Kalimpong, much closer up, apparently, to the snows of Mount Kanchenjunga, much more definitely Nepalese in character, and also much less Europeanized than at the time of my previous visit. This visit had taken place in 1945, when I was still in the army, and I had vivid recollections of the Chaurastra and Observation Hill, as well as of the Tibetan monastery at Goom. Whether on account of the rarefied atmosphere of the place, or whether because the rains being over and gone, the festival season, the season of the autumn pujas, was now coming upon us, a marked sense of exhilaration prevailed. The rose-cheeked young men seemed more animated than in Kalimpong, as well as healthier and happier. Seeing their cheerful, mongoloid faces, I could not but feel more animated myself. So much so, indeed, that before long, I had seen all the things I wanted to see and met all the representatives of religious and humanitarian organisations I was supposed to meet. At least half the people I met in this capacity seemed to be called Mr. Lama. Tall or short, fat or thin, wearing traditional Nepalese costume or a version of Western dress, there were Mr. Lamas by the dozen in the town, the only difference between them in this respect being a bewildering variety of initials. Nor was this all. Not only were there Mr. Lamas by the dozen, there were Mrs. Lamas by the dozen too, as well as an even greater number of Master Lamas and Miss Lamas. Now, Lama, I had always understood, meant spiritual superior and signified a spiritual teacher or guru. Was there then a whole tribe of gurus in Darjeeling, gurus of both sexes and all ages, from the lean and slippered pantaloon to the mewling and puking infant? The mystery was soon cleared up. The Mr. Lamas were the hereditary priests of the Tamang Buddhist community. Once upon a time, they, or their ancestors, had been real lamas, real gurus. But corruption had set in. They had married, founded families, and adopted secular occupations. Now they knew no more about Buddhism, no more about the distinctive teachings of the Nyingma Pa school, to which they traditionally belonged, than did the rest of the 18 septs into which the Tamang community was divided. A few of them still officiated in the temples on a part-time basis, but most of them had not functioned as hereditary priests, even to this very limited extent, for several generations. Far from signifying a spiritual teacher, the word Lama was no more than a family surname. Most of the Mr. Lamas were well aware of the true nature of the situation. Some reacted to it by wanting to throw away the ritual bathwater along with the doctrinal baby. Others looked away from the Nyingma Pa tradition altogether and in the direction of Bengali Burmese Theravada, a small outpost of which existed on the outskirts of the town in the form of the Gandhamadan Vihara, a branch of the Bengal Buddhist Association. Mr. Lamas of this type were, however, comparatively rare. Like the rest of the Tamang community, nearly all the Mr. Lamas, as well as all the Mrs. Lamas and most of the Master and Miss Lamas, had a strong sense of ethnic and religious identity, and thought of themselves as being definitely Tamangs and definitely Nyingma Pa Buddhists. Weak as they may have been in knowledge, there was no doubt that they were strong in faith and devotion, to the extent that devotion can in fact be thus separated from knowledge. At all events, their devotion was sufficiently strong and their material resources sufficiently plentiful for them to have built in the heart of the bazaar area a Nyingma Pa temple of the typical Nepalese pagoda type, and it was this temple that gave me the experience that was, spiritually speaking, the climax of my entire visit. I had never seen an image of Padmasambhava before, perhaps not even a painting. As I entered the temple, all the greater was the shock, therefore, when I saw in front of me, three or four times larger than life, the mighty sedent figure of the semi-legendary founder and inspirer of the Nyingma Pa tradition, a skull cup in his left hand, a staff topped with skulls in the crook of his left arm, and the celebrated wrathful smile on his moustached face. All this I took in instantly, together with the lotus hat, the richly embroidered robes, and the much smaller flanking figures of his two consorts, one Tibetan and one Nepalese. Having taken it in, I felt that it had always been there, and that in seeing the figure of Padmasambhava, I had become conscious of his spiritual presence, that had in fact been with me all the time. Though I had never seen the figure of Padmasambhava before, it was familiar to me in a way that no other figure on earth was familiar. Familiar and fascinating. It was familiar as my own self, yet at the same time infinitely mysterious, infinitely wonderful, and infinitely inspiring. Familiar, mysterious, wonderful, and inspiring it was to remain. Indeed, from then on, the figure of the precious Guru, Guru Rinpoche, was to occupy a permanent place in my inner spiritual world, even as it played a prominent part in the spiritual life and imagination of the entire Himalayan region. Though seeing the figure of Padmasambhava was the climax of my visit, there was another experience in store for me before my departure. This experience took place not in a temple, but in a bookshop. Browsing round the shelves of either the Oxford or the Cambridge bookshop with Sachin, there were no bookshops in Kalimpong, I came across a dozen or more slim volumes in light blue covers. It was the cheap Indian edition of the works of Rabindranath Tagore. A glance was enough to tell me that here was a treasure indeed, and since the volumes were so moderately priced that even a penniless monk could afford them, I at once bought Fruit Gathering for Sachin as a puja present, and Stray Birds for myself. Stray Birds was a series of more than 300 poetic aphorisms. Some of these aphorisms moved me deeply, though others I found jejune. Subsequently, I learned that they were not really aphorisms at all, but Tagore's own adaptations of the Japanese haiku, and that he had started writing them on his visit to Japan, where he was frequently called upon to contribute a few lines to the album of some friend or admirer. Adaptations or not, the form of these little effusions appealed to me greatly, and not long after my return to Kalimpong, I started producing poetic aphorisms of my own. Like Tagore's, these aphorisms were the spontaneous overflow of some of my more intimate thoughts and emotions that might otherwise have found no outward expression. As Tagore himself put it in the opening aphorisms of the book, quote, "Stray birds of summer come to my window and fly away, and yellow leaves of autumn, which have no songs, flutter and fall there with a sigh." In the course of the next 2 years, I was to produce more than 100 of these free adaptations of, or variations on, the traditional Japanese haiku, stricter imitations of which, both rhymed and unrhymed, I continue to write. While not producing nearly so many of them as Tagore, in one respect at least, I went one better than the great Bengali poet. Though each of my aphorisms was complete in itself, I arranged the majority of them into a sequence in such a way as to tell a kind of story. This development did not take place until nearly 3 years after my experience in the bookshop, when I had made the journey from Kalimpong to Darjeeling at least 3 more times. Meanwhile, my first, or rather my second, visit to Darjeeling was at an end. Some of the people I had met, including 3 or 4 of the ubiquitous Mr. Lamas, had suggested that a branch of the YMBA should be started in Darjeeling. I had bought myself a copy of Stray Birds. Above all, I had seen the figure of Padmasambhava. I therefore returned to Kalimpong well content with the success of my mission. While I was taking Dr. Ambedkar's advice to heart and coming out of my shell, as he put it, Joe stayed firmly in his. During the 4 days that Sachin and I were away, he did his best to keep the evening tutorial classes going. Swale had dropped out some time before, but it was not easy for him to do this single-handed. And upon my reappearance in my accustomed place on the bed by the window, I was greeted not only with broad smiles of welcome, but also with sighs of relief. The matriculation and intermediate arts examinations were now close at hand. There were only a few more weeks left for preparation, and the students were anxious not to lose any more time. By popular request, the duration of the classes was increased, so that they encroached on the time hitherto reserved for ping-pong and carom-board, while additional classes were held on Sunday afternoons. Soon I was more deeply immersed than ever in the teaching of English and logic, and what with this and other YMBA work was kept fully occupied. Indeed, during the rest of October and until well into November, it sometimes seemed that I had settled at the Dharmodia Vihara for good, that there stretched before me an unending vista of classes, lectures and editorial work. But this was not to prove the case. Though the YMBA was to continue becoming better known, both inside and outside Kalimpong, there was to be a temporary setback, and I myself was not only to come further out of my shell, but to be thrown out of the nest altogether. End of chapter 5.